This episode is brought to you by WizCon. WizCon is a 1,000-attendee feminist intersectional science fiction convention in Madison, Wisconsin. And this year, WizCon is leveling up its gaming. From their evening tabletop games to their panel format gaming discussions, they would love to have new friends from the gaming community join their party. For more information, visit wizcon.net or follow the link in the show notes. Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. My guest this episode is Caitlin Bell, creator of RPGs, LARPs, video games, and many strange things in between. I was introduced to her work via Kirigami Dominatrix Simulator, which is exactly what it says it is. But you probably heard about A Real Game, which took home the Indie Groundbreaker Award for Best Game of 2016. Groundbreaker is really the best word to describe Caitlin as a designer. In content and in form, her work pushes the boundaries of role-playing. The personal, provocative, unsettling, and erotic are often meticulously pulled apart through play, and I found the results so intriguing that I had to have her on the show. So let's jump in! Is A Baby Fell from the Sky. Yes. It's very interesting to me because everyone argues about something and has to make a decision within a small amount of time is like such a good LARP template. But at the same time, it does feel distinctly weird compared to other games of that variety. What is this game about?
Well, it is about pretty much what it says on the tin, that an alien baby has come down from the air and landed in a small town in the south, and it's kind of poisoning the entire community with radiation and doing a lot of strange things, and it's summoned 4 to 6 people to its resting place to make a decision about which one is going to leave with it tonight, and no one really has any information on what that means or where you'll go or what'll end up happening, and everyone's kind of at each other's throats and unhappy, and so you're basically trying to come to a consensus when you've lived your entire life in a town where no one can come to a consensus.
Right. Is it in some way about community dynamics?
It's a lot about... It's an idea I had for a while, but it sort of got influenced after the recent election and sort of things that have, the fallout that's come from that, that's definitely played a bit into it. But for the most part, it's really about wanting to connect with people that I feel we should already be able to connect with, because everyone in this town is already their own community, but they're still infighting and they're unable to connect with each other, even though they should be friends and neighbors and the like.
Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to play it much?
We've done a couple of playtests, and a group of friends of mine took it for a spin just to make sure they could do it when I wasn't there. It does what I want it to do, I think. I kind of want it to be longer, but I sort of pace the games and like the time that they'll take with how long I think you can actually stand to play it.
Which, yeah.
That sounds a little more derisive than I mean it, but like, I sit down with some games and I get a sense for how long they want me to play it. They'll put like a time limiter in there or something. But I feel that the games that I'm making are really direct and they're getting right to the point of, they're jumping right in. You're not doing a lot of fleshing out or anything. So I think you can only wring so much playtime from that. Kind of like Fiasco. Fiasco lets you know when you get on board, this isn't going to be a very long play. It's going to be a really quick thing. And I like that.
That's also part of what drives like the pace of Fiasco too, is like you're really, really pushed to sort of like get to the meat of a story and or of a scene and resolve it really quickly.
Yeah, I like how hard it frames the scenes and what have you. because I think Fiasco is one of the first sort of indie games I came to after having played so many other things where I was expected to make a really long, in-depth kind of character arc and play and what have you. So it was really kind of jarring to just get into a scene, do it, and then get out as quick as you can. But I think it's been really instrumental. I think it's been really instrumental to a lot of people in kind of development. It was a lot of games I see are trying to just kind of get you in there to the point and then get you out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what artifacts of that do you think you can see in your designs now?
Well, like, as far as my own stuff is going, they're all pretty much paced for about an hour. And I think that's from a sense of wanting to edit out and wanting to get rid of kind of what I consider the boring parts of play. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. I know when I would play Dungeons and Dragons and Vampire the Masquerade and all, there was a lot of setup and build-up that I think we kind of felt we had to have in the game. Like, that was part of how you told a story, which you had this really long fleshed out build-up. But then when you're playing Fiasco and you're just getting right to what's exciting in the scene, and then you're just jumping out, I think that's the shit-taking editing, really. So, like, I'm trying to do that a lot with my stuff, where I'm just trying to make a document and then cut out as many pages of it as I can.
Right, subtraction. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of your games are very short and extremely focused, kind of isolated experiences. Is that something that you're driving for, or just an sort of incidental to what you like?
Part of it has to do with being an adult and not being able to get the amount of time I'd really like to do role-playing, you know? Like, kind of how you could back in high school when you had a lot of free time and you could get together and do that with your friends, but now everyone has to work and I've only got weekends off and what have you. So I kind of have to make a design that's going to really get in there, for one, and just kind of work through the main idea I want it to show. But again, a lot of it is just, it sounds bad, but a lot of it is just being really, really bored with story.
Yeah, yeah. The short attention span, I can relate to that.
Yeah, I'll watch some movies and I'll think that this could have been 20 minutes shorter. That they put things in there that I don't think were necessarily needed, but I think that's part of how, again, how we're telling stories now. I think we've got this idea of trying to flesh out as much as possible and presenting a longer product just for the sake of presenting it. Whereas when I'm making something, I'm really excited about one specific thing and one specific interaction. So I just try to do that.
Right. And that can be, like you say, extremely specific. Mm-hmm. You have two games, one called Bugfuck and one called Orgy in the Fens, right?
Yes.
And these are both games that are, like, seem aesthetically similar. They're both about, like, weird sex. They're both, like, similar in format, where it's, like, a group sort of freeform game. And yet, they seem to be saying really, really different things, or essentially about really, really different things. Can you compare and contrast those for me?
Oh, sure. Yep. Bugfuck and Orgy in the Fens are, on a surface level, as far as, like, the format and what you're doing, pretty similar. But Orgy in the Fens assumes that you are presenting the story about friends and people who are willing to explore and willing to be with each other, whereas Bugfuck is putting you on neutral ground and making you earn that right. I made Bugfuck as a response to that because I felt that part of the takeaway of Orgy and the Fens was that this was easy, and I don't think that forming relationships, especially sexual relationships, is always easy. And I wanted to kind of touch on that in a way that I felt the first game didn't. So in Orgy and the Fens, you're all students in, like, a wizard's academy who are graduating, and they've decided to have an orgy to kind of celebrate. And it's more about trying new things and experimenting and seeing where you can take a relationship with people you care about and trust. Whereas in Bugfuck, you're just gross little bugs who are trying to get action one night, an hour before you die, because bugs die quick. And instead of being guaranteed the option that you are in Fins, you have to go up to people and you have to, like, earn that. You really have to make them believe that you're worth having sex with or even spending time with. And I just wanted to make sure that I had both sides of that represented in kind of the body of work, because I felt it wasn't present in the first game, because I felt like it was telling a different story and that didn't need to be. But with this one, I wanted to make sure that was something I was saying.
Yeah, that sometimes it's really hard. Sometimes it's really shitty dating and getting involved with people in that way. You also have, I think, one of the best dying in space LARPs, which is Our Radios Are Dying. That's also a two-person game, which I'm particularly fascinated by. Was there something about the two-person format that appealed to you, or was there something about dying in space that spoke to you?
I felt there. It's both. With the two-player format, there aren't that many two-player games out there. And, I mean, there's a library there, but I feel like they tend to want to do the same thing. And I don't know that I necessarily accomplished a lot of variety with Our Radios Are Dying, but the idea was to try and put a new situation to what two people are doing. But the game itself also is just kind of about isolation, but isolation with someone. And it was sort of a meditation on a lot of bad relationships and friendships that I was having or dealing with at the time, and kind of hoping that these things didn't end without actually saying the things that I needed to say. And also sort of worrying if people aren't telling me things that they wish they could, and just kind of the strength of the relationship there. So I felt that game actually started out years and years before it got published. And it went through all sorts of revisions and drafts, and it had everywhere from six people down to just two. And I think that in the end, just having the two people in there is really kind of necessary for what it's trying to say.
That's interesting. Do you think a lot of your games are about relationships?
In an extent, in that the things that I really like in stories are how relationships build and fall. We talked about Fiasco. Fiasco is really good for that. That's pretty much entirely the whole crux of Fiasco. And that's what I'm really interested in when I'm playing a game. So to an extent, they are about building relationships and maintaining them and what happens when that goes sour, just because those are the stories I'm most interested in telling.
Okay, now I get to ask you about this game of yours that won the Indie Groundbreaker Awards Best Game of the Year last year, called A Real Game, which is a game about so many things. I feel like it's about 15 different things, and it's specifically designed to be what, like, you want it to be about within a certain range. But one of the themes that you touch on is this strange and sort of unacknowledged disconnect between role-playing and storytelling in these games that we play that involve so much of both. Can you expand on that here a bit for people who haven't played the game?
Yeah, with A Real Game, I was really surprised how many interpretations have jumped up about that. I think that there is a disconnect, really, between how we want to tell a story and what we want to include in that and sort of the formal process of sitting down to do it. We kind of have this mental image of getting together in a room to do a LARP and sort of standing and moving around, or sitting down with cards or dice and paper and doing that. And there's not a lot of variety there. There's not a lot of different ways that we are approaching role-playing. Mm-hmm. And the game itself kind of feels weird about that, because it's on a meta level, that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to role play with you in a very strange and specific sense. And wonders if it's actually doing a good job. It's kind of like a sentient game, and it is afraid for itself. And it's kind of a fear I've had with some of the stuff I've made before that point that I never published, because I wondered if it was not role-play-y enough, you know? Is this not enough of a game? And for me, that's one of the primary meditations of that game. But yeah, I have seen that it's opened up to a lot of different interpretations, which I am in no place to call invalid, so.
Right. The game poses a lot of questions, and a lot of those questions are around worth and value. The game itself asks you, you know, was I worth the money? And I read that. I'm going through the game like, whoa, whoa, game, that's intense. And so there's these interesting parallels drawn between like the value of a game, which is often like commercial value, and the value of the game designer and what piece of your own value goes into a game. Do you feel like you came to any conclusions through making that game, or is it just like questions, questions, questions?
God, I wish I had come to more answers than I did, to be honest. I think like part of that, a very small part of making that game, was also me thinking about the value of what I had made and like being afraid to ask a price for the stuff. A lot of those PDFs were free before then, because I felt that they were not, I felt like I almost had too much gall to ask for money for them. And, yeah, it's hard to kind of decide what your own work is worth. It's very difficult to do that. And, I imagine that that's something that people, even accomplished designers that are still, that have been doing it for years and are still doing it now, probably have trouble with. How much do you ask for this? Is this technically a game? Is this something I should even be showing off? But that's actually one of the most acclaimed things I've made. So I think in a way that has shown me a lot about what I can do and how I can approach things and sort of the way it'll be accepted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you a bit about the way in which you publish games, right? Like right mm-hmm. now you have an itch.io page.
Mm-hmm.
And what kinds of decisions do you make around like, here's how I want to get my work out there and here's how I want to make it available or who I want to make it available to?
I had their own Patreon for a full month before they go on sale to the public. And I was originally just fulfilling them manually because I was, I had such a small body of work. It felt weird trying to put them up in a storefront, but, really they're just up in itch.io because it's a simple way to get those out. They, I don't get the money as quickly because itch.io keeps, it keeps the stuff and then it kind of sends you in a bulk price. Like I think once a week it'll send you stuff if you've gotten something, but it's a lot easier. But I don't advertise a lot really. I just kind of put it in one place and hope that whoever wants to find it will find it, which it's not really a good strategy. I don't recommend it, but it's working out. But for me, it's just about making it as accessible as I can, and that's why I was doing it manually. But then that got to be kind of a pain.
Yeah, there is this weird balance between accessibility and like valuing your time and effort as a creator, right?
Yeah, that's something I struggle with a lot, and I know other people do too. I think a lot of times the market out there for games isn't very helpful for that either. You look at what's actually selling and what's gathering a lot of attention, and I think you're more willing to look at a game, kind of a weird little thing, and say it's good or interesting or appealing, but you're more likely to put your money behind something that's established and more in tune with how you want to play.
Right, yeah, or something that just you recognize because it's, you know, because it's a hack of something else that mm-hmm. you know, or because it comes in a big book with a nice cover, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think, like, people are already pretty trusting of, like, the Apocalypse World system, So those do really well just off, you know, name alone. They're all really good games. I'm not trying to imply otherwise, but I think a big selling point is saying we already have this established system and it's very good, and we're just going to do more, better, good things with it.
I know what you mean. And I hear a lot of uncertainty, I guess, around, like, are people going to be interested in this? Is, you know, are people going to respond to this? Is anyone going to buy this? With those things so uncertain, what keeps you making games? What keeps you putting them out there?
Feedback is very helpful when people tell me they're excited about the things. I publish pretty much every game thinking, this is the one that was just for me. This was the one weird one that I just kind of published just for myself. But people keep playing them, and I've gotten a lot of really nice and incredible feedback from people who told me that they've liked things I've made, and that I've influenced how they've made stuff. And like, being part of the community is really helpful. Seeing that you're having an influence on someone, and that like your game has won an award, or that it's being played on podcasts, like, you get to a point where you're thinking, I guess I'm doing something right, even if I'm a little uncertain about this, even if I think this one's a little odd. If people are really into it, then so am I, and I'm happy for that.
Yeah, and what a wonderful feeling, right? Do you hear from people? Like, people just being like, hey, guess what? I loved your game.
Oh, yeah, I've got a regular crew of people on Twitter who are constantly telling me that, which is so flattering. I've also been really lucky in being able to talk to some established designers, some very famous names out there that have given me a lot of feedback on my stuff and told me that they've been into it and really enjoyed it. And like, it gets to a point where it's almost impossible to kind of keep feeling imposter syndrome. Like, I know it doesn't work like that, but like, when you keep saying no, 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 and everyone else is super excited about it, it gets kind of difficult for me logically to say, this isn't good. So I just get really excited these days about putting something out to see what people are going to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people don't realize just how much of an impact small things like that can have, right? When you just like get a little tweet that's like, hey, you love your stuff, or, you know, especially when it's someone you respect and admire, but even when it's a total rando, like, it makes a difference.
Oh yeah, every time that's happened, it's felt really good, and it's made me like retroactively more excited that I've made that. Like, stuff that I haven't looked at or thought about in years, you know, when you get messages that someone really enjoyed it, it's really nice. Also, on a similar note, one of the best things I did, I think, in my early career for designing was to just email people whose games I liked and ask them questions about it and tell them how their stuff was impacting me and how it felt to play and to be a part of that with them. And sometimes people will email you back and talk to you, and sometimes they won't. But that was really influential, and I encourage anyone who is starting out making something or not confident in their stuff to find people whose stuff they do like and just try to open a conversation or dialogue with them. That it's one of the best ways to process this stuff and to make yourself excited about it.
Yeah, totally. I think people underestimate how like available a lot of people in the analog kind of game space are. Like, everyone I know who's making role-playing games, generally speaking, they're really excited to like boost other designers and encourage other designers, like, just as a general rule.
Oh yeah, definitely. I don't think I've ever seen someone who hasn't done that. Like, I'm really proud of the community that we have, that we are constantly running contests or talking about design or just willing to help each other out.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you gotten to do much mentorship? Like, are people approaching you yet and being like, Caitlin, look at my game?
Not as much as I'd like. I would have a really big ego If I got more people doing that, I would be excited for that. But I have seen that, and I've been able to talk to some people about their work. And as much as I think it's a good thing, it's also kind of an awkward feeling being on the other end of that. Like, I love hearing feedback on my stuff and thinking about it and chewing it over and then making changes that I feel need to be made. But telling someone changes that need to be made to their stuff is really hard. And like, it's very easy to suggest something, but I don't know, you're looking at something that someone has put a lot of effort and a lot of work in and a lot of love, and you're trying to tell them that parts of it just don't work. So it's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's helpful. It's really helpful in the end.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, what advice do you have for givers of feedback? Like, both as someone who's been on either end of trying to do that and trying to help other people out with their games, what are your best practices?
My best practices are to make suggestions instead of declarations, for one. It's a lot easier to digest something if someone is saying, here's what I think, as opposed to here's what's wrong. I think another big thing is to not come to a specific conclusion about what needs to happen to something when you're telling someone about their work. Don't tell them what they can do to change it, but rather to kind of suggest that it's not doing maybe what it's intended to do, because you don't want to make someone's game for them. And you want them to come to those decisions themselves, and you want them to feel that someone is not trying to alter or destroy their work. So when someone's coming to you for feedback, they're really trying to hear, you know, your opinion on what it is and how you feel about the product overall and its individual components, I guess, as opposed to what needs to be like changed. You're hoping for something positive there. And I think as much as you can to try and make that sort of a welcoming experience and to make it seem like you're doing something good already with your product. You just need to tweak it a little bit more.
Well, good. I hope everyone listening to this knows that you should totally hit up Katie for the good, good advice.
Oh, please do. Please do. I hope I'm helpful.
I wonder, you know, it feels like a lot of that is done informally, and a lot of that is done, yeah, just through like new designers emailing more established designers, you know, or tweeting at them or whatever and going from there. I don't know. I would like to set up more active mentorship that way. And I wonder what that would look like or what that would require.
I wish that was going on a lot more. Yeah. Like, I wish people would see or like got to experience just how easy and open people can be towards asking for help. I mean, I know it's a difficult thing to kind of open up and ask a stranger what they think about something, like if it's an established name or even sometimes like your friends as well. But it's so important and it's so helpful, especially to get feedback from someone who has been doing this for years and been doing it for a long time and kind of understands aspects of design and publication in ways you haven't even thought of.
Yeah, exactly. Just someone with experience, right? Whether or not they are a good or better designer than you is not the point of mentorship, right? It's just, do they have the experience? Have they already made mistakes you haven't made yet?
Yeah, it's just, have you thought of something that I haven't really? Like, I've learned a lot of stuff from people who haven't made anything, as much as I've learned from people who have made a lot of money from what they've put out there. So, yeah.
What kinds of perspectives do you seek out?
I am specifically looking for clarity, if you understand what I'm trying to say. And I'm also trying to look for where things fall apart. Like, I'm really happy when things are working and when they are going well when people play, but that's not helpful for me going forward, because I can emphasize that, but I really need to take out the parts that aren't contributing first. So I need to know if people understand this and if they're able to use the tools at hand to keep going.
Right. There's like this big scary chasm that has to be crossed between, can you play this game when I'm running it, and can you play this game without me in the room? How do you make that jump?
So I have an in-house group that I play stuff with, and I have people who are nice enough to that I do not live anywhere close to who are nice enough to take my games every time and go and try those out and to just read them critically and tell me. And you just have to, it can be hard, but you really have to send that out to as many people as you can and just say, do you understand it? Or do you understand it? Are you able to do this without me telling you what this means? It's pretty much, it's a step of design all on its own, is going back and make sure your stuff is understood.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. You kind of got to just do it, don't you?
I mean, it's not the most thrilling part of shopping your stuff around, and it's very time consuming because you're asking for reading comprehension, but it will save you so much time and effort in the long run.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's another question that I run into with a lot of designers, where early on you have this idea and it feels amazing because it's an idea and you're like, hell yeah, and you have so much energy. And then you even play it a bit and you're like, okay, cool, this is still really fun. And then you get to that like last like 20% of working on the game where it's just like fine tuning and testing and putting it in a layout and that kind of thing. How do you maintain the energy to see projects through to the end?
I often don't. that part of that part of design sucks. And there are yeah. so many documents in my Google Drive that attest to that have not seen the light of day, simply because fixing the problem versus raw creation, they're just two entirely different things, and one of them is really fun and one isn't. Because when you're making something, it's just again raw energy. And the kind of reining back and tuning of that often seems, it can seem impossible at times. Sometimes you make something and you have to see it a certain way or see it in a certain light, and you can't think of any changes you can make to it that will allow you to keep up that same feeling. And you have to go back and edit it, and you have to change things, and it feels like an entirely different idea. So you have to approach this new idea from a new perspective and then tune that, and you're just getting, it adds a lot of effort and work to what was for you just a really easy process where you just kind of zoom through and just made something. So it is arguably the worst part of making something is having to go back and change this beautiful idea you had into something that's actually workable.
To kind of pivot a little bit, you have this essay on your website about immersion, and I'll link to it in the show notes and people can read it. But, and I wonder, like, why are we doing this? Do you have any theories on why we do this weird ass thing?
Storytelling is really fun. I think everyone gets excited when they're able to tell a story, even kind of outside of like a formal process, like when you're able to, if you have something interesting happen in your day and you're able to go tell your friends, you're really excited to tell them, hey, you know, let me tell you guys about this weird thing that happened to me, and you get really into it. And I think we like impressing people and being impressed by what they have to say in return. And so I think sitting down to pretend we are other people is, In one aspect, a way to impress others. I think we are making characters and telling stories with our friends in mind, and we're thinking of what would get them excited and get them interested. I know when I am making things, I am thinking about specific interactions I might have or that this game might have in the future, and there are people in the community or friends I have that I'm hoping will pick up on it and be excited about it. But I don't know. We started pretending to be elves and aliens, and we just found weirder ways to do it. And we've kind of focused on like the efficiency of doing so and sort of the nuance of it. And I don't know, there's not really a space to do that kind of thing outside of this. There's not really, I mean, you've got video games, but you don't have the freedom with those that you do with role playing. I mean, there's a lot of parallels there, obviously. But, yeah.
Let me pick up on that piece about freedom and and digital games, because you work in the digital space quite a bit, actually. Like, you've made Twine games and that kind of thing. And to me, I'm just realizing now that you use the lack of freedom in that context to an advantage, because so much of your games are about submission. Man, this isn't even a question. I just came to this realization. I feel so smart. What's the fun or sort of advantages in general, besides my incredible insight I just came up with, of working in the digital format versus the analog?
When you're looking at the Twine stuff, when you're able to bring something to the table, you've got almost complete freedom with it. But then when you move off of that, to that extent, I'm also working with Ben Lehman on a video game as part of a team there. So I've gotten to take a look at that process as well. And
cool.
Jumping from analog to a digital space is, you do lose a lot of freedom, but not necessarily in a bad way. Something I'm able to do, like with the Twine games, is to direct you down a specific path, whereas with a PDF document or just a set of rules, I've only been able to hint at that or suggest that you do it. And I can't really control what you do from there or if this follows the same vision I had. But you get to guide that more. You get to sort of put that on a specific path and tell a story. I can't say that it is, I don't know if that's necessarily a better one. I do have a lot of reservations about it. But I feel that they are two different beasts entirely, and you go to them for two different reasons. You'll approach, in all the Twine games I've played, you're approaching them for a specific experience as opposed to sitting down to role play.
Right. And so in one, you really kind of have an idea of where you want people to go. And the other one, you're like, I wonder where people will go.
Right. And that part is exciting. I get excited, like with the real game, like we talked about, how people have just taken that and told me, here's what the game's about. And it's been just something I've never even thought of. Whereas when I made Welcome to Aurora, I had a very specific image in mind of what I wanted someone to experience. And I don't know, I think that talks about immersion a little bit more in a way, because when I'm looking at a digital product, I'm wanting to specifically experience someone's vision, as opposed to when you give me a set of rules and I'm wanting to create a brand new vision with the people I'm sitting with. So I guess that's kind of like a meta immersion in a sense, if that makes sense.
Yes, I feel like it's partially beyond my comprehension, but I think it does in the abstract make sense. Can you tell us more about the video game that you're working on with Ben Lehman? That sounds really fun.
What I can tell you about it is that it is about a Mongol princess. It is supposed to be a kind of like an old school role-playing game where you've got a party and you're going around fighting monsters and kind of traveling the world to help save it. But we've gone through a lot of changes and a lot of different dynamics. So I feel like any particular thing I would tell you about might be changed by the time it came out. But we do have a large team of really, really very talented people who are showing me part of a process that I'd never seen before and never thought I would be involved with. Like, I'm practically on there designing like subsystems and ways to make the player interact with the mechanics that we have in a way that will be interesting and fun, but I'm also getting to see how people are coding and how they're putting things together.
It's so exciting when you get to be on a project that is both like you feel like you're contributing, but also you're learning so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have never really volunteered myself to be part of creating any kind of video game because that was not a set of skills that I thought I possessed, but I'm learning that there's actually a lot of room for a lot of different talents aboard that. You know, they've got writers and they've got programmers and they've got people who are just sitting there trying to figure out how to make something work, how to get from point A to point B. So yeah, it's not something that I thought I would be doing.
Mm-hmm. It also sounds like it's a very collaborative effort, and a lot of your games have been solo. How do you feel about working in that context?
I have a lot of fun with it. It's nice to be able to kind of share some of the responsibility when I'm making something by myself and it's not working out. I don't have very many options to turn to. I kind of just have to maybe get advice and then sit down and try to figure it out. Whereas with this, I can go to someone in like a team effort and ask what they think or even get them to work on it. When we did my singularity with Josh Jordan, that was something that was really exciting because I got to just go to him and say, I don't know what to do. What do you think? And then get a lot of good feedback. And it didn't really feel like a cop-out. Like, I felt like if I did that with something that I made by myself, if I just went to someone and asked them to design part of it, that maybe that's not quite the same thing. But with this, if we've all agreed to work together, then, like, the cross-pollination there is so helpful.
Yeah, that's really handy. You know, when I talked to Josh about working on Singularity, he said something like, I would just come up with these ridiculous ideas and then Caitlin would actually make them work. And then he said, but if you asked her, she would probably say that she came up with the crazy ideas and then I actually made them work. Are either of those things true? Are both of those things true?
I 100% believe that I came up with the crazy ideas and he had to rein it in. I believe that 100% because I was throwing some weird stuff out there. And also in this other thing I'm doing with Ben Lehman, I'm throwing just a lot of weird ideas out there. And it's helpful to have Josh or someone say, you can't do this. You have to slow down. This is a little too ambitious for what we're doing. And that's also something that's really good. When you're working collaboratively, is you don't often see the limitations of what you're doing or the product you're making until the very end, and you have to go back and rein it in. But here you get to see that a lot sooner. Josh was able to tell me when something was interesting or when it wasn't. He was very good at that, or when something needs to be focused on or strengthened versus not. And it's kind of like having several hours of playtesting in one conversation.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, actually. Yeah, just having that ability to have someone respond and think of things that you hadn't thought or run into things that you hadn't run into.
Right.
Huh, fascinating. So Singularity is obviously rad. I hope people go and check that out. This digital game that you're working on sounds like it is pretty exciting. What else is out there and in the future or that you're working on right now that you're really, really excited about?
Something I found out is that when I show people the stuff I'm working on, I inevitably throw it to the wayside. Like, I feel like it's a curse almost. like right now I just released Artemis over Patreon, which is about and continuing the long tradition of finding weird ways to have sex in my games. It's about having sex with a spaceship. And to do it, you actually arrange furniture in your play space and pretend that that is part of the spaceship. And you just do weird stuff with it. It's a very niche game, but so I made that, and I'm really excited about that. I've got a ton of stuff that normally the stuff I'm making is a lot smaller and is over pretty quickly, but I've got a couple of things that I'm trying to push out that are longer games. I have a game about this group of people who are getting together to make an artifact. They're trying to make something. It's a fantasy setting, and they're trying to make a powerful item to go and combat a great evil. And it's based off the actual idea of making an artifact in play. The idea of, like, you make a physical item and it exists outside of your gameplay. Even after the session is long gone, you still have this physical reminder. And I think that's really cool. So I've made a game where a bunch of people are getting together to actually arts and crafts an item, a weapon to come with. The problem with that is it takes an immense amount of work and instruction. So that is probably not something that's going to see the light of day anytime soon. Something that I am looking to push out pretty soon is probably even next month if I can, is a game about a party where a bunch of rich people get drunk and hedonistic, and they end up killing one of their friends and decide to cook and eat him. And you play the game with actual food at the table, pretending this is the flesh of someone that you used to know. And it's kind of an Edgar Allan Poe story where you're kind of dealing with madness and guilt and trying to kind of come to terms with what you've done while getting through the meal. I'm really excited about it. I'm just, it's not the most accessible thing right now. So those two are really the things I think will come out sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Okay. That is, I'm really interested in people using food in, in like LARPing right now. That's really interesting to me. And the fact that it has this whole like coming to grips with the fact that you benefit from the suffering of others.
Yeah.
Little twist on there is like, oof, woo, woo. Oh my, how interesting.
You know, kind of in that vein, I was actually vegan for about 6 years. Until very recently when I came away from that. So I am kind of re-experiencing food and re-evaluating that in a way. So that is something that I don't think is a forefront of it, but is something that I had in mind when I was thinking about. But I think really anytime you can get sort of a tactile thing, an item at the table, and you can kind of imagine its history and what went into it, that kind of adds in a dimension to play that might not even have anything to do with what you were playing, but is something that fills your imagination and makes you reevaluate what you're doing. Yeah.
It just brings a level of consciousness to it, mm-hmm. right?
Right,
right. Oh, gosh. All of those things sound very, very, very exciting. All my listeners should go to your Patreon so that they can get cool sex games in advance. But then everything on your Patreon sort of eventually flows into your Itch account, right?
Right. It's on there for a month before it comes into actual play, which is a very long time. But it is just sort of a thank you for all the people who have – I've got patrons on there that have been there since I started and who are – very kind and give a lot of promotion and feedback for me. So it's just kind of a small way to say thank you.
That's wonderful. I mean, speaking of, you know, we talked earlier in the show about ways that you can like show that little like waving flag for people whose work that you love, and Patreon is such a wonderful way of doing that.
Yeah, Patreon's really, I mean, honestly, it's really revolutionized how we're publishing things. I'm super excited for it. It lets you... You get kind of that immediate monetary kick from it, which is maybe not necessarily why you're designing something, but when you're worried about worth and value, when you have people who are willing to drop $5 or $10 or whatever sight unseen on a product just because they believe you'll make something good, that's a very good feeling and it makes you want to make more.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Okay, what an excellent feeling to end on. I love that. So if people want to keep up with you and the work that you're putting out there, where should they go?
You can go to caitlinbell.com, which is kind of where I have a link to everything. So anything and all you want to find out about me will be up there. And then I have my Patreon, which is at patreon.com/caitlin.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was really fun.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
Thanks again to Katie for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening. If you like the show, consider giving it a nice rating or review on iTunes. Or tell a friend about it. Either of those things make me very happy. Remember that if you want to get in touch with me, you can always email me or tweet at me. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com or at backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.